Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Copla Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilvas. This is episode 43? 42? 43? I'm not really too sure because I have big old COVID brain, guys. I've really had to drag myself out of bed to record this intro and outro and finish the edit for this. Yeah, last Thursday, I just got struck down for like a big old piece of shit. So I'm surprised it took me this long to get it, but I got it. I'll say that, I've been being safe. So, but I've got an absolutely fun episode for you. I spoke to Carson Green, which like feels like it was ages ago now. It wasn't that long ago. It was only like a week or so ago, but... time is moving real slow at the moment, so I feel like I've been inside for like 100 years or something like that. The film we talk about is The Birdcage, as is always the way. We will talk about this film in complete detail, so there'll be spoilers aplenty all the way through our really fun kind of, we try and dissect as much around this film as well, kind of would this film be made today, kind of looking through 2022 eyes. I know some of you may roll your eyes like, is this podcast woke? Yes, it fucking is. If you want to get out now. But yeah, this one was lots of fun, so all that's left to do is to head on down to South Beach. Let's have a right old hoot as we get to know our new favourite family and make some Copla connections. Today, we're headed to South Beach to meet Armand and Albert as we look at the 1996 comedy The Birdcage, directed by Mike Nichols with a script adapted by Elaine May from the Jean Prenault play Le Cage à Four. The film stars Robin Williams, Nathan Lane, Gene Hackman, Diane Wiest, Dan Futterman, Calissa Lockhart, Hank Azaria and Christine Barinski. The art department coordinator and this week's Copla Connection is Stephanie Schwartzman. To tread the boards with me and to foss, Madonna, 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 our way through this film and determine if the Coplas are the greatest film family of all time or they need to change their ways to conform to a conservative society is pop culture critic and one half of the great Movie Mavens podcast, the Albert to my Armand today, Carson Green. How are you, Carson?
Hi, thank you for having me. What a beautiful intro.
I thought this film deserved, if anything, it deserved more sparkles. I feel like I should be strutting out to We Are Family.
It's definitely, we should have put on a full show. I feel like we should be in drag.
Feather boas, yeah. Like one of the things before we get into some of the regular questions here, I've got to say up top, is I'm really tempted to adopt Robin Williams's wardrobe as my like summer look. Those kind of like loose leg trousers look really comfortable and probably like great in the heat. You can kind of like, I don't know, stay covered, but also like I don't know, breezy and fresh.
He was unnecessarily sexy in this movie.
we'll get plenty to how sexy Robin Williams is in this.
But good.
Before we do that, let's tell us a bit about Movie Mavens up top. Like, what is it you guys do over there?
Yeah, so Movie Mavens is a podcast, obviously. We do double features. We call it a spicy double feature. So each week we watch two, sometimes more movies, and then we compare them. And they're generally related in some form or fashion. We can do genre or director, actor, main character, that sort of thing. But we've never done a Coppola double feature, but now I feel like we have to.
I know, you've done a Sophia one. I've started listening to the Sophia's popped up, and obviously Nicolas Cage himself is a Coppola, so they've popped up on the podcast.
Yes, but that's never been the connection.
Yes.
And I feel like now we have to.
just a homage to what I'm doing over
here.
Amazing. I'll say as well up top, like listening to your podcast, it's amazing. So anyone who's listening to this, bookmark that you'll listen to Movie Mavens as soon as you finish listening to this chat.
Hey, thank you.
No worries. Well, one of the things I always like to ask my guests before we talk about the film is, when did you first become aware of the Coppolas? And like, what was your entry point, whether it was an actor or director from the family or whoever, and when did you realize like, whoa, there's loads of these guys out there? Well, yeah, what's your kind of history with the Coppola family, as it were?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this, and there's two moments that I thought of that I don't know which came first here. The first one would be Jason Schwartzman. I watched the Wes Anderson Darjeeling Limited when it came out. I think it was like, that was my first Wes Anderson movie, which is weird. I think it came out in like 2008, maybe. And then right around that time, I also watched The Virgin Suicides, the Sofia Coppola. And I think that's from 1999. So it was one of those, but I didn't know about the Coppolas until many years later.
Yeah, but for my own sins, like whether it's watching a lot of their films or even knowing about them as the extent, like the amount of guests I've had on being like, I knew there was a few, but then like I send out like a document with the family tree that people would have seen on socials from time to time that I post, and it is just, it's crazy, like the amount of kind of, not just the influence, the influence they have as well. Like it kind of seems like people who get invited into the family for a brief period go on to do like great things, whether it's like a Spike Jones who kind of married Sofia Coppola, then his directing career kind of took off from there. And then, do you know what I mean, Patricia Arquette marrying Nicolas Cage, for instance. I'm not saying it is a direct influence from the Coppolas, but it's kind of, it's funny how that works out.
Yeah, I always forget that Nicolas Cage is a Coppola.
Yeah, he changed his name because he didn't want to look like he was getting nepotism, but then happily like featured in several of Francis Ford Coppola's films in the 80s. So it's like, I will distance myself from the family with one hand, but I will take from the family with another.
I don't know. I admire nepotism. I would love to have like a family that could give me some sort of nepotism.
Yes. It's something that's been discussed on this podcast before, is how it seems to be in the arts, if it's like a family business, like how it is with like Sophia and Roman kind of growing up on the sets of like Apocalypse Now and stuff like that. They went on to be film directors and film writers and stuff like that. And that's like, people see that as dirty, like in a way. They're like, oh, they're only at that place because of who their dad is. Yet, I don't know, if like you go to like a family run bistro and it's like, oh, this restaurant's been in the family for like four generations. Everyone goes, what a great place. Like, I love this place.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? The rich history of this, do you know what I mean? It's like, well, the son only knows how to cook because his mum or dad taught him like working in the restaurant. Like, that's the only reason they've got that. But I don't know. I don't know what it is about Hollywood where everyone's like, I don't know. I guess it boils down to whether those people on their own right are talented, right? And I guess Sofia Coppola has proved she's not just there because of who her dad is. They probably got her in the door, but then obviously her second film won an Academy Award. Like,
yeah, right. I think it also has to do with money. Uh-huh. You know, like you can watch these people own this bistro and know that like they're not raking in millions.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, in Hollywood, there's just an abundance of movie or money all the time. And I think that's where people get upset. Like, that's where the hang up is. But for me, you know what? Get your bag. Like, exactly. Go. in any way possible.
And I think what makes the Coppolas interesting is Francis Ford Coppola is constantly on, like, the verge of bankruptcy throughout his career. So,
right.
So it's like, I don't know. I'm sure when he has the cash, he's like, Sophia, yeah, go make a film. But like half the time he's like, I got nothing to give you. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
I've pumped all my money into making a movie and I'm not sure if it's going to succeed or not.
Yeah, it's like, I gave you the name, go work it, figure it out.
But yeah, money might be another question altogether. So I'm all right in believing you live out in LA, right? Have you?
I do, yeah.
So have you ever come in contact with a Coppola? Have you ever past Sophia on the street? Have you ever seen Roman getting a taco or anything like that? Have you ever had the privilege?
You know, not on purpose. However, maybe on accident. Maybe I've been in the same room. I mean, I've been to some cool events. Uh-huh. Maybe I've been in the same room as a Coppola. Let's just go with yes. I have been in the same room as a Coppola.
You've breathed the same air, most likely.
Yeah, most likely.
Perfect, perfect. So someone once said they saw Phantom Planet live and they counted that as
meeting
a Coppola. So I'm like, we'll take whatever if you've been at a fancy
gym. Oh, you know what, here's something funny is I work in marketing and I was working on a movie a couple of months ago, and the studio that I was working with, I went into a meeting with them and the guy told me that he had just come out of a meeting with Nicolas Cage about his latest movie, The Unbearable Weight, or what's it called?
The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So at least tangentially, I've been in maybe the same meeting as Nicolas Cage.
Perfect, perfect. I love it. So what would have been your first film that would have involved Stephanie Schwarzman? I know that's a difficult one because she's very much kind of behind the scenes in movies and kind of has a small IMDb list of credits. But yeah, did you manage to check out her IMDb and see which of her films you would have seen first?
I did not, but I'm just going to go ahead and assume it's The Birdcage because I've been watching this movie since I was a child. I remember watching this like very young. So I'm just going to go with The Birdcage.
Amazing. Amazing. Yes.
What else has she done? Anything like that I would know by name?
Yeah. So yeah, her like credits are really interesting. So she did Edward Scissorhands. She was like kind of worked in the props department on that. Ed Wood. Memoirs of the Invisible Man, The Little Princess, is it? The Alfonso Cuarón film.
Wow. Okay, I've seen all of these.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. She's got like this kind of like amazing like behind the scenes career just for like the 90s, kind of worked on all these bangers and then was just kind of like, I imagine, that's not what I want to do anymore. Like I've had a taste of the family business. It's not for me.
Oh my God, Ed Wood is a twofer. Patricia Arquette movie too, right?
Yes, yeah. But yeah. I think pre Nicolas Cage marriage. So yeah. Let's talk about The Birdcage. But before we do, here's the trailer.
Pop, I'm getting married. It's a girl. I met her at school. It's this wonderful... Are you upset? But let me tell you why.
Don't use that tone to me.
What tone?
That sarcastic, contemptuous tone that means you know everything because you're a man and I know nothing because I'm a woman.
You're not a woman.
Oh, you bastard.
Are you crazy? You can't get married. It's out of the question.
We've been sleeping together for a year.
Oh, God. Has he been tested?
Oh, Kevin.
Yes, and so have I.
Oh!
Who's his father? His father is in the arts.
You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. Or Madonna, Madonna, Madonna.
But you keep it all inside.
What does the mother do? She's a housewife.
Oh, I can play it straight.
You take your knife and you smear. Men smear.
Smear,
that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get the pinky down. All right, hold the knife boldly and straight.
No, I'm gonna pierce the toast.
Al, you old so-and-so. How do you feel about that call today? I mean, the Dolphins, 4th-and-3 play on their 30-yard line with only 34 seconds to go.
How do you think I feel? Betrayed, bewildered.
Call me.
Perfect. Won't you come in?
Senator Keeley, Mrs. Keeley, come here and give me a hug.
I've never felt such tension. It's like riding a psychotic horse towards a burning stable.
Oh God, it's a nightmare.
Get up, everybody, and sing.
Something about the father and Mrs. Coleman. I can't put my finger on
it's
it.
It's nothing.
What do you mean?
It's nothing.
It is
Dad,
something.
It is nothing.
Something very strange is going on.
We are family.
So this film was released on March 8th, 1996 with a budget of $31 million and grossed a box office of $185.3 million. I think it was
wow.
The seventh best movie of 1996. Yeah, so it would have...
just the seventh best.
Yeah, it was the seventh, like, well, not bad. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, financially,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah,
so,
grossing, yeah.
Yeah, so it was trails behind Independence Day, Twister, Mission Impossible, The Rock, shout out Nicolas Cage, Ransom, and The Nutty Professor. So, what?
Wow.
So, yeah, I'll ask you to give us a plot for this film. What is a synopsis of this film? Yeah, like, how would you describe it? Awesome.
So it's about this club owner in South Beach, Robin Williams, and his son wants to get married to a senator's daughter. And the senator just so happens to be a conservative asshole who is going through some political problems. And sort of like antics arise because Nathan Lane, who plays Robin Williams' husband, decides upon herself, to play the wife in the meeting of the parents, and antics ensue.
That's perfect. Yeah, obviously I said in the intro to this that it's based on a French play. And you can definitely tell that, right? Like, it kind of has the structure of, you could see this kind of mounted on the stage. I know there's a 1978 movie which spawned two sequels. So like, now I'm really excited to be like, I really enjoyed this world. I know the original is in Criterion Collection, so I guess that gives it like a stamp of approval somewhat, like whatever you think of the Criterion Collection. So I'm like, I'm excited to watch that, go back to that and then go like, oh, I can spend more time with Armand and Albert. Yes, please. Despite it not being Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. But yeah, what was your kind of introduction to the Birdcage? You said you saw it young, but like, what's kind of your relationship been with it over the years as well?
Yeah. So I started watching it, so something about me, I grew up in Alabama. which is a very conservative place. And my mom grew up in California, and so she introduced me to a lot of culture that I otherwise would not have known. Uh-huh. And the Birdcage was part of that. So we watched it at home because she loved Nathan Lane. She thought he was a riot, rightfully so. But I remember watching this movie and like wanting to talk about it with my friends, and like none of my friends had seen it because of where we grew up. But like it didn't diminish. And in fact, I felt myself like part of a club because I had seen it, and it was like a very adult movie, and it was very like, you know, there was gay people on screen. Like, are you serious? Like, yes. Openly gay people. And so I think like every time I've watched it since then, which, you know, I've watched it over the years, I just like, yeah, I feel sort of like part of a secret gay club. It's it's nice. It's very like, and to that point, like it's very inclusive, and it's very like, I don't feel no judgment, or, you know, like any of the commentary, any of the political commentary, I don't think any of it is about queerness or drag queens or like gay marriage or anything like that. I think all of the political commentary falls entirely on the other side of the aisle, which I really appreciate that. I like it, especially for 1996.
Yeah, and obviously, like, for me, it was the first time. I kind of, like, when I told you, you were surprised, like, when we were messaging beforehand. But what I found quite striking about it is the messages and the kind of themes that it deals with, like, unfortunately, are still relevant today. Like, there's kind of, like, topics of, like, discussion in this, especially, like, when Nathan Lane is pretending to be the mother. And pretending to be uber conservative, like there's kind of references made to abortion, like done in a kind of like, do you know what I mean, a palatable, humorous way, but
yeah,
obviously is a massive kind of epidemic in the US at the moment, kind of with the laws that are being passed. And it's like, if anything, like things like that, the kind of conservative view on the LGBTQ plus community in the US and the UK as well have got worse. It's not like we're kind of looking back at this and be like, oh wow, look how kind of backward thinking conservatives were then. Like they've softened. Like if anything, they've like doubled down and got worse. So it's kind of like it feels evergreen. It's obviously, I feel like there's elements of it that wouldn't probably be done today, and that like whether it's like to do with casting, like I wanted to play this clip because Hank Azaria was asked about the role that he plays in this of Agador Spartacus, and he had this to say.
It was, I mean, I had a lovely time doing that, working with the great Mike Nichols and Robin Williams and Gene Hackman and Nathan Lane and Diane Wiest, and it's one of the first movies I ever did. It should be pointed out that it's a role that I would not play today, and rightly so. It would go to certainly, although I grew up in a Spanish-speaking household. I'm a Sephardic Jew, and my parents both were fluent in Spanish, but and spoke it, you know, with their families in place of English a lot. But it's not a role I would play today. Absolutely, and rightly
really?
So. It would go to a genuine Latin actor, and perhaps even a genuinely gay actor, and I'm thrilled that I got the opportunity to play it. I enjoyed it. I loved it. But it's not a role I would play today.
But yeah, I think that's like one of the kind of sticking points, and one of the things whilst researching this, I kind of listened to some other podcasts, like kind of from queer content creators, to kind of like, obviously, yeah, like regular listeners to the podcast will probably assume, and rightfully, that I am a cisgendered white male, heterosexual man. So obviously I wanted to get that those perspectives, whether it is from other male perspective, but from that queer perspective or female perspective and stuff like that. And like, A lot of the points I heard was that this is a film that's about the gay experience, but it's for a heteronormative crowd. Would you kind of jive with that? Do you think it's kind of aimed towards a more, it's aimed towards us straights, not the gays?
Yeah. So I want to first comment on what he said, that he would not take this role. And I think that is extremely admirable. I wish that more people had that attitude. And I think like now in Hollywood, I think we're kind of moving towards that, where people are maybe more apprehensive to play disabled roles, to play queer roles, to play, you know, roles that they don't necessarily like fit the bill. And I appreciate that he said that. I really, really do. I wish that more actors were that way. However, I will say that I can't see anyone but Robin Williams playing this. And yes. I don't think he was queer.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like in my research, finding out that originally the cast for this was going to be Steve Martin in the Amand role and Robin Williams in the Albert role. So,
wow. Oh, wow. I can't see Steve Martin doing that. No. But I will say, okay, I am a queer person, so I feel like I have some authority.
Amazing.
Here. Okay, sorry. What was the original question? I wanted to go back to what he said.
Just in regards to, like, is this a film that is, like, skewed more towards a straight audience as opposed to a queer audience?
Oh yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there when it's palatable, and I think what like the conversation that Nathan Lane has when he's playing the mom, the woman character, and he's sort of like throwing out these really extreme takes about conservatism and like, you know, just American politics. Like, those are what I mean, you know, that's a lot of like what people actually think. And so while it is like kind of wrapped up in this humorous way, it's still ultimately validating for the straight experience, for kind of the fringe you know, characters. And I think too, what works here is that Robin Williams was such a huge force in the 90s that straights and gays alike flocked to him, and he was welcoming, and he was an easy kind of character and person to latch onto. And just like he made everything okay. Yep. He could, you know, he could play any character and it would just be like, oh, it's just Robin Williams playing a character.
And I think it like speaks to the point that like, unfortunately, we live in a society where stuff like this has to happen. But you also, like, imagine at a time like the 90s, you need that massive name like a Robin Williams to get people through the door. But then you're kind of introducing them to like what would be deemed as like a subversive way of living. Do you know what I mean? That obviously isn't. But obviously, yeah, in the 90s, even now, like people, I don't know, they'll happily see a film. Do you know what I mean? Like you get Oscar Beatty, Matthew McConaughey in like Dallas Buyers Club, and people go and watch it because like, oh, it's Matthew McConaughey. I love him from all those films where he's leaning against his co-star with his top off in those rom-coms.
Right.
I'll go watch this movie, and then you're kind of, oh, you're showing a story about HIV or whatever. And I guess like this and on the other, yeah, this kind of in that same vein, but as a comedy, it's kind of like showing, yeah. And I think in the way it kind of plays towards a straight audience as well, is one of the things I noticed is like there's not overtly like affection towards each other, like between Armand and Albert. Like there's never like a kiss or anything like that. It's kind of there's touches and stuff like that, but there's never like embraces and stuff like that. And the plot line as well is kind of like, I don't know, there's it's really interesting in that like it kind of gently deals with kind of whether it's like internalized homophobia or kind of yeah, the queer experience of having to shrink yourself to be accepted in a wider society, but kind of does it with a spoonful of sugar that, like, kind of, I don't know, you can take it on the surface level just being a bit of a farcical comedy, but then it, I think it does have something to say. And I guess it would be like an entry level film to maybe people experiencing more queer stories throughout cinema.
Yeah, I think to your point, I think that the plot point of, like, they're breaking up, and we get that, like, in the first scene that we see them together in, is that they're breaking up. And so, yeah, there isn't a lot of embrace. There isn't, you know, physical touch. And it makes it easier for straight people to watch. However, I was thinking about this, like, I watched it as a kid growing up in Alabama, right? As a queer kid who, like, would not come out for very many years. And I was just thinking, like, I wonder what this was like for, you know, like, older people in the LGBT community to watch and see themselves represented on screen in this huge Hollywood blockbuster. I mean, this is a Coppola film, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is huge. I wonder what that experience was like, especially in the 90s. Like, you know, people in Alabama, sure, went to the movie theater to see this, and it wasn't weird. It was like, you know, they could go and see themselves represented on screen to some degree. Like, you know, that, I don't know, that's like, I like that. That's heartwarming to me.
So, talking about, like, the film, like, you talk about the opening, what are some of the moments, like, sort of scenes that always stand out to you when you think of The Birdcage?
Okay, so the dinner scene, obviously, but, like, with the soup bowls, I didn't get that for a long time. But yeah. I remember seeing it as a kid, listener, in this scene, they're being served soup, and in the bottom of the bowls are naked men, presumably performing lewd acts. And there's this whole thing about, oh, let me borrow your glasses, let me see if I can, what are they doing here? And I didn't get that for many years. And then when I did, I was like, oh, okay. So definitely that scene, and then all of the performance scenes, all of the drag scenes. I remember watching those, like, growing up, and just thinking, like, look at them, like, having fun and being themselves. Like, this is dope. This is rad. Mm-hmm. And then also, I remember being really confused during the scene where Robin Williams goes to see Val's wife. Or not wife, Val's mom.
Yeah.
And like, their whole exchange. So that's a time when we do get physical touch.
Yes.
She sticks her hand, like, down his shirt to, like, feel his chest hair. And I just remember being really confused and being like, hang on a second. Like, he's married to Albert. He's like, he's preoccupied. Like, what do you mean? What is this?
What's interesting about that as well is that, like, she seems more turned on by him for the fact that, like, she even comments on, like, how masculine he looks with the hairy chest, because, like, he used to shave it back in his kind of theater days and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a confusing scene, but in the way that, I don't know, like, he's gone there just to ask for help and she's hitting on him. And it's like, and I think that the chemistry between Lane and Williams, it does, like, you, I don't know, I was there like, no, don't do anything, Jerry, like, being the first time watching, I'm like, no, don't stop this, stop the dancing, do you know what I mean? I was like, invite Albert in, like, you've popped the champagne, get Albert in as well, it could be lovely. And then, like, yeah, he obviously does walk in on the moment when the hand's on the chest and storms out, rightfully.
Yeah, I think that scene was played for straight audiences. That's not a scene for representation. That's definitely played for, like, oh, look, here. Wait, don't forget. Don't forget. Here's what straight people look like. Sorry about all the gayness.
Yeah, I guess that and the film ends on like the heterosexual like couple getting together and like getting married, and it ends on like a kiss from them. Not like it kind of, it's no longer about Armand and Albert. It's all about Val and Barbara instead, and it's like, oh no, like kind of, I wish it had that, like, I don't know, the fairy tale ending for those two characters. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know,
yeah,
one of the stage productions of it ends with like a musical number. I think it was a Broadway show in like the early 80s. So like, yeah, it ends with those two ascending a staircase and kissing in like, and then it goes to black, and it's like, ah, that's what I end. That's what I want for this film. I want a big, like, and that's the thing. That now knowing there's a Broadway musical version of it, I'm like, how great would this have been? Like, it's great as it is, but like, if this were a musical, it would have been even better.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, even the wedding though, like I think of the wedding, I think because it was put on by Armand and Albert, like I think of it as a big gay wedding.
Yes.
Even though it's two straight people getting married, that's a big gay wedding. I bet that would be a really fun event to go to.
So let's talk about that relationship between Williams and Lane. Like, what do you think of their chemistry and how they kind of bounce off each other in this film?
Oh my God. From the moment we first lay eyes on Albert, when he's sort of having like a drag meltdown, yeah. In his dressing room, and he's like, he's beside himself because Armand has decided to leave him, to call it quits. And it's just like, it's so dramatic, but at the same time, like Robin Williams' character, Armand, he just like, he brings him back down to earth. He's like, okay, you're in the clouds. You're like losing your mind. Come back down and perform in this club that we have together and relax. Like, let's all just take a deep breath. And that scene just like, it introduces their kind of like, their relationship and like their dynamic in a really beautiful and funny way.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of like without missing a beat, like their whole chemistry, their relationship just like it unfolds in a really, again, like palatable but also endearing way.
Yeah, I love that the film kind of starts with like a Goodfellas-esque, like Martin Scorsese, like walk through the club. And you've kind of got like Armand like attending to people, being like, oh, the Kennedys are in, like, I'll give them a round of coffees on me and stuff like that. And then I think he said he turns up to their table. He's like, oh, save some room for some coffee. Like, yes. I love all that stuff. And then like Hank Azaria being introduced, and like he's like the kind of costume, the houseboy, but also like Albert's kind of, yeah, dresser when getting ready for drag. And like just the small details about like the Pirin tablets, and like Armand's like, oh, you're drugging him, what are you doing? And he's like, no, I've just scratched the A and the S off of aspirin tablets. It's like, it's genius, I love it. Yeah, I think you're definitely right about how it sets it, like really easy, like, I don't know, tightly sets up their dynamic as a couple. And like, I don't know, you kind of, you get the sense that Armand is like, in the kind of comedy sense, is the straight man, and then Nathan Lane's Albert is more of the kind of like wild card madcap like comedy character in it. And I love that. I just love their dynamic. I just found myself like watching this film, and obviously we've talked about like some of the, I don't know, sticking points of the some aspects of this film, but I think I found myself just smiling throughout. And I haven't, like, I just like ugly laughed a few times, and I watched this on my own, I could only imagine what it would be like to watch it. Like, I'm definitely gonna be bookmarking it for any like revival houses over here that are showing it, just to see it with like a packed out audience of fans, because it was so fun to watch on my own. So I can only imagine what it'd be like to watch with a room full of people.
Yes. Oh my God, A Room Full of Queer People. That sounds like that sounds like a lot of fun. I'm gonna look for like a showing here. I bet they are showing it. It's Pride, you know. I live in LA. I bet it's here. I'm gonna try and watch this. but I wanted to comment on oh my God, what's his name? Spartacus. No, but what's his first name?
Agador.
Agador Spartacus. Okay, that whole thing was so funny. But I wanted to comment on his physical comedy in this. Oh my God. Everything he does is so funny. And like, he always has like a straight face. Like, he's always very concerned. Like, he's, you know, he does his job really well. But like there's this scene where he just like completely trips over himself. And even like, even the stuff of like the first time we see him cleaning and he's playing Gloria Estefan and he's got the wig on and he's got these short shorts on and he's just, you know, like he's having like a very like straight conversation, like about, you know, business and work and life. But he's just like, he looks so goofy. Yes. And he's always playing the part.
What I love about like Hank Azaria and like something around this film is that whilst he was prepping for the role of Agador, he's good friends with Billy Bob Thornton, and he was prepping for Sling Blade at the time. And they drive around in their cars just like in character. So you had Billy Bob Thornton and Hank Azaria like kind of pretending they were like in a buddy cop film, but just like keeping their characters on the whole time. And I can only imagine like what that would have been like if you had like, they had pulled up next to you at like a stoplight or something like that, just to like see those two, like especially yeah. Hank Azaria doing that. And it's, yeah, I think it's like an underrated, I don't know, like, yeah, you can see this being like, I don't, when I saw that it was like a 70s, it kind of has that feel of like a European like kind of farce to it. Do you know what I mean? I can imagine it being like even more over the top, maybe, like especially if it's made in like the 70s and stuff like that, like really falling over and like everyone falling. And the stage version, I can imagine like even more so, because obviously they've got the people in the nosebleeds have to really see the movements for it and stuff like he's perfect.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What about the rest of like the supporting cast? Obviously, we got powerhouse Gene Hackman in this, who obviously playing an absolute piece of shit. And then we have Diane Weiss, who I think was only 16 years older than Clarissa Lockhart. So like,
wow,
could have never have like, yeah, like, oh, could have been a mum, but like, I'm sure like as a conservative, 16 would not have been an appropriate age to give birth to a daughter.
Yeah, I just, on this, I want to comment on, while, yes, this is incredible, like, queer representation, it's also, we also have kind of a cringe sort of situation in terms of relationships, in which this is definitely a grooming situation, right? Like, Val is, what, 20? And Barbara, she had just turned 18, and she makes the comment. She says, oh, yeah, we've been sleeping together for a year. Oh, my God, the way I, like, had a full-body cringe. Like, I don't think – see, like, I think that we could remake all of this, but now if this was made in 2022, we would definitely age those two characters. Like, that was the most
– yeah, the only thing I can think about that is maybe like it was something like in the translation that they just didn't change, because obviously like the age of consent in the UK, and I think France is the same, is 16. So like so I guess like that like giving the filmmakers a benefit of a doubt on that, that's the only thing I could think that would be. But yeah, definitely, like it is a sticky situation, especially in America. And I'm surprised that, being the ultra conservatives that they are, that they didn't like jump on that point when she mentions they've been sleeping together for a year, and like,
yeah,
she would have been underage.
No, that was really like the only like cringe, oh my God, this aged really poorly. But I think that, like, that whole family, I think Gene Hackman, Diane Weiss, I think they played a really great couple. I think they riffed really, really well off of each other. I think they complimented each other well. And they were really funny. They were really funny because they played dumb so well. Like, they were believably stupid, which is... it can be hard to do, but they were believably stupid. I really appreciated that.
What I love in the dinner party sequence is the kind of like to and fro we have, where as an audience we think they've like cottoned on to the fact of like the ruse that obviously they are gay men pretending to be straight, or the fact that it's not an actual woman, it is Albert dressed up as a middle-aged stuffy conservative woman. And like, you get those moments where, like, I think, yeah, Gene Hackman says like, there's something up with the with Armand and the butler, or there's, do you know what I mean, like, I figured it out and stuff. There's that moment where he's like, I figured out what's wrong here, and then he goes, yeah, like Catherine, like the mum, she just has to put up with Armand and his European ways and stuff like that. And it's like, I just love that kind of stuff, because they are just, they're portrayed to just be really dumb, and it's very much, it's wearing its kind of liberal like stripes on its arm, and it's like, yeah, fuck those conservatives.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and like, you know, it, there is so many more believable scenarios before they arrived at gay. Like, they could be anything else. These people could be con artists before we would believe them to be gay people, which is so
even when you get to the reveal, right, even when you get to the, like, when it all comes out into the open, they're like, senator Keeley, like Gene Hackman's character, just still can't believe it. Even when like Nathan Lane's taken off the wig, he's like, what is going on here? And like, I guess that point, it's something I don't quite get in this film, is that if they didn't have to sneak through the club, because obviously before that, like, they say to Barbara, that's it, you're coming with me. And she says, oh, I would have loved to have been a part of your family. So we can assume that the wedding at that point would be off.
Mm-hmm.
But once they sneak through the club and get on their way, then they get married. I guess, yeah, this film is missing is a kind of like a changing of heart scene for the Keelys. We never get that kind of like, oh, gay is okay scene from them. It's kind of we go from them like, Senator Keely in drag and Diane Weiss like dressed up to, oh, then it's the wedding. There is never really, I don't know, you never see a change in their kind of, or not overtly, not at all, I don't think, of the kind of character's outlook on homosexuals.
Yeah, I don't think that would fit in here.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like as much as I would appreciate that scene and I do crave that sort of like on-screen validation, I don't think it would fit here, unfortunately. And if it did, I don't think that it would have played as well in 1996 if there was this like gay is okay. I think the fact that we end on the wedding is like, that's all we're going to get out of this is, you know, they let their daughter marry into this gay family.
Yeah. It's also, it's more subtextual than it is kind of context of the film. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other points. Yeah. One of the points I wanted to ask you about is this one of like Robin Williams' more restrained performances? Cause obviously like he's known for being like quite out there. Do you know what I mean? You think like a couple of years earlier it would have been in Miss Doubtfire, where it just seems like, I don't know, he's a voice actor, so it's an excuse for him to do wacky voices, and there's the whole character of Miss Doubtfire is him to just put on this kind of proto Shrek voice almost and stuff like that. Like, yeah, what do you think of his performance in this, and is it one of his more measured?
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess, yeah, he is really constrained. And it makes me wonder if it's because he wanted to give this queer representation on screen a fair shake. Uh-huh. You know, he didn't want to play, and this is just me speculating, maybe he didn't want to play like a hugely overtly, you know, flaming person who maybe would turn off audiences.
I know he said like that, like he asked Mike Nichols if he could play Armand instead, because I think he, yeah, to your point, like had kind of played all these wacky characters and kind of quite flamboyant characters up until that point, that was like, I want to try this out. And I think it was a right decision, because I think Nathan Lane is perfect for this role, and somebody who wasn't actually openly like out in the world at that point in his like life, or in his real life, hadn't actually come out. And there's a really interesting moment on Oprah where she tried to out Nathan Lane on TV, and just shows like how much of an ally and like nice guy that Robin Williams was to Nathan Lane as well. Have a listen to this.
To work with people that, first starting with Mike Nichols, who is sort of this legendary.
Were you afraid
director.
Of taking that role and being like typecast and people forever saying, are you not, is he, honey, I don't know.
Girl, you changed just in the middle of that sentence. I don't know, I'm telling you. Don't make me come out there.
So?
What was the question? All right. Being typecast, well, not really. I mean, I'm not, I don't have an image to uphold. I'm basically a character actor, and I'm not a sex symbol. I sort of, from role to role, I'm usually pretty different. And the material was so incredible that I don't know how you could, you know, turn it down, because you would be worrying about your image. It's a wonderful character and very nurturing.
Didn't you just love playing him, her, sometimes? Especially when she was her. Especially this.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a.
When he was her.
There
yeah.
was a big sort of production number in the beginning that was cut, but I came out and there were like 200 people in a nightclub and I had a great time. And yeah, it is sort of freeing once you put on, you know, big leopard boots and a cape. You know, you kind of have to let go.
I find that really interesting. Like, do you know what I mean?
And
Nathan Lane has gone on record saying like, I'm 40, single, and I work a lot in musical theatre. You do the math. What do you need? Flashcards. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think he said he didn't feel comfortable saying it to anyone, especially like not live on TV with Oprah.
Yeah.
Like, which is yeah. And I think I don't know, Robin Williams jumping in kind of to divert the situation and maybe give Nathan Lane that breathing space to kind of
yeah
think of a measured answer that yeah was is a beautiful thing to I don't know
yeah but, no that's a great ally moment. That was definitely an interception of, hey lady, watch it, okay?
Yeah, there's you can kind of miss it in that clip because it's all kind of quite frantic, but like Robin Williams really like quickly says like, what was that? Like,
yeah,
if, like kind of like calling out Oprah being like, What are you doing? Like,
yeah, that's not the conversation we're having.
Yeah, we're here to promote a bloody film. Like, let's not his sexuality has nothing to do with it. We're playing these characters right now.
And yeah, also, no, what I got from that clip, first of all, I miss Robin Williams. What a great like, what an incredible personality. What a great, I was talking to a friend about this the other day. And he was saying like, isn't Robin Williams everyone's favorite? And I just thought like, no, actually a lot of people don't, you know, like kids these days, they didn't grow up with Robin Williams like we did, you know, mm-hmm. he wasn't this powerhouse in so many funny, you know, like kid comedies growing up. Whereas like, you know, we grew up with him and he's a staple.
But I hadn't
heard his voice, maybe like him doing him until this clip. So thank you for playing that. I love him. He's a beautiful soul. But Nathan Lane also just like an incredible actor. Like, who do we have nowadays to compare him to? Like, who can we? It's like, I mean, this is just like a powerhouse duo.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, like I've been thinking about what the remake of this is like would look like. And I just don't want it to be remade. This is so good.
Yeah. I'm trying to think who, like, because I know it was like muted in the 80s that Dudley Moore and Frank Sinatra were going to play these, like do a version of this, like for film.
God.
And I'm like, I'm so glad that didn't happen. It kind of felt like it came out at the right time with the right actors, and I think Robin Williams' performance in it, like, I don't know, I've seen a lot of Robin Williams, but like some of his more like, I don't know, I guess more adult centric stuff, like this this in the UK is a 15, I think is rated R in the US. Like, I haven't seen a lot of like that stuff where it's like the Fisher King and stuff like that. I feel like other films that came out in 96 that Robin Williams was in, like Jack and Jumanji, mm-hmm. I've seen those two movies like plenty of times, but like this slipped under my radar for so long, and like kind of it's always on my watch list but never got around to it, and I'm so glad I've watched it now, and so thanks for picking it.
Do you think it's because it was a queer movie? Not to call you out in any way,
I had no idea what it was, like, do you know what I mean? I'd genuinely because the regular poster, like the Blu-ray I got of it recently, like there is no like denying that it is possibly a queer movie because it's like a pink case, do you know what I mean? Like, whereas I think the longest time, and I think it's because of the original posters and like the kind of slick back hair that the kind of the dress and that. I always got confused with Dirty Rotten Scoundrels for some reason, just because I think they've got similar posters. And I just thought it was about, like, yeah, I thought it was about a couple of club owners. And I thought it was about a club owner. I never, like, that has never been an issue. Like, it sounds like, what is it? The lady doth protest too much, like me kind of like protesting. No, I've never had a problem with like with queer representation on screen. But like, no, I don't think it was ever that. I just think it was, I don't know, like I'd just end up watching other stuff. Do you know what I mean? If it had cropped up on streaming, I'm sure I would have dived on it. But like, yeah, I had to order a Blu-ray to like watch it like this time. So I would have easily have watched it. And I'm sad I didn't.
You know what? You're here now.
Exactly. Yeah. Better late to the party than not at all, right?
Yeah. I think that's interesting, though. That's an interesting point of, like, this movie definitely was marketed a very particular way. Maybe so that it could play in theaters in Alabama. And so, like, it could, you know, be at a video rental store, like, in rural Arkansas or something like that. You know, it's definitely marketed a certain way to where they didn't want to allude to the fact that it was a queer story in order to maybe market to the masses, to make it, more palatable, which I'm so glad we're over that. I'm so glad we can be out and proud and loud.
Definitely. Well, before we kind of start to wrap things up, is there anything like from the film, whether it's like thematically, scene wise, or members of the cast that we've missed that you would like to talk about?
No, you already touched on the Pirin pills, which is such a great detail. I love that. I mean, there's a bunch of like really fun and quick one-liners, like when Nathan Lane says that he went to go visit his parents in West Palm Beach or something like that. And then they were like, wait a second, I thought they were in Cocoa Beach or wherever they say. And then he says, oh, yeah, well, that's what my parents always said, is live in Cocoa Beach and be buried in West Palm Beach.
I love that. Yeah, in that sequence, we're kind of like of him playing this ultra conservative like mum. Mm-hmm. We're dropped into like conversations like halfway through. There's a moment where they're talking about like killing abortion doctors, and like Nathan Lane's character says like, what I say is we kill the mothers. Like, you may be thinking the fetus will die, but I say they, like, it goes down with the ship. And it's like, you kind of like, it takes you back, but it's like, I don't know, it almost presents how kind of twisted these views are. Like, people genuinely have these real views and stuff like that. And I guess, like we were saying with like queer representation, it kind of puts it in like, not that it necessarily has to be palatable packaging, but it puts that kind of, it sneaks in these top like these kind of conservative issues and kind of how ludicrous they are in these jokes. And I think that's really great in it. And to the point of like, we've talked about how funny this film is, I think there's like beautiful moments of kind of pathos and like just beauty. Like I love like the small moments between Nathan Lane and Robin Williams. Like there's that moment where they're a beautifully framed shot as well, where they're sat on that bench.
Oh yeah.
And he pulls out the palimony papers, like, and kind of explains like, everything I have like is yours and stuff like that. And it's, yeah, moments like that are just really tender and sweet. And like, I found myself watching this film as well. Like, and obviously like, I can't relate to the queer experience or kind of, I can obviously empathize to it, but like, I think there's like things in here just for that feeling of otherness and kind of like, if like, even like if you're like a liberal person and like butting up against like kind of conservatives, like I've had relationships in the past as like somebody called Petros Patsilivus having to like,
that's a great name.
talk to partners and like parents who are uber conservative, like about issues on, like, I don't know, like, yeah, a few years ago we had a referendum here whether the UK would leave the European Union. And it's mm-hmm. like, oh, I was asked once, like, what are you voting? And it's like, my name is Petros Patsilivas. Like, what do you think I'm voting? I'm like, I'm a European man. Like,
yeah, right.
And like, yeah, I kind of found myself, I don't know whether it is that thing, like, you always look for stuff that you can relate to in films. And I found myself like kind of relating to that stuff as well. And obviously, yeah, as I said, like empathizing to the kind of stuff that I couldn't, like, don't have direct kind of experience with.
Yeah. That's crazy that the world is still so backwards all these years later that yeah. this is the movie we're looking to relate to.
Yeah, it's a shame that kind of, yeah, as I said earlier, we can't look back at this film and go like, look how crazy people used to be.
It's yeah.
Like, oh, look how crazier they've got since then.
Yeah. I did see, so you posted on Twitter that we were watching this movie and someone commented, and they said it aged poorly, or that they didn't think that it aged well. And I wanted
to kind disagree. Of dive on that and ask as for why. Like, I normally ignore those kind of comments because it's like, if you don't want to take the time to expand on your thoughts, like, or I don't know, like, yeah, I noticed in this article, like, these points, like, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, yeah, like, can imagine there being like some kind of, I don't know, article being like 10 reasons why the birdcage is harmful to the queer community or something like that. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only thing that I can think was what I mentioned about maybe it's a grooming situation. I feel like, you know, I could do without the age thing there. But otherwise, I think, like, as a queer story, I don't think it's aged poorly. I think it's really fun. It's still really fun to watch. I'm not offended by it. I, like you're saying, you know, like, we get all of these, like, really heavy topics thrown into jokes, which are not funny, but I don't know, it's good. This is a great movie.
Yeah, so sometimes we need stuff and, like, I don't know, we need a sugar pill to kind of swallow that hard stuff. So yeah, to have a film like this that kind of sneaks that stuff in and mm-hmm. it's a riot, like, it's an absolute riot from start to finish. It's just like, it doesn't feel like it overstays its welcome. Like, as I said, mm-hmm. I'm eager to check out the original. I'm eager to see if there's like a filmed version of the Broadway play, eager to check out the sequels to the 1978 film. Yeah, I am now free from the bird. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
you watch this space. You'll see me strutting down South Beach in no time, dressed just like Armand. I'll be rocking a mustache. I'll be in silk shirts and linen trousers.
I can't wait to see it.
Getting some, is it Schmeckle, that little cake that Nathan Lane has? That's an aspect I love about this film as well, is that it shows how integrated and kind of pillars of the kind of community that Armand and Albert are. Like, just in that mm-hmm. small scene of, like, Albert kind of in the bakery and stuff like that, you just get a sense that they're like, I don't know, they found their place, they're happy with who they are.
Yeah.
And obviously, it comes like the butting of heads with, like, do they need to shrink themselves, like, mm-hmm. change their ways for their son? Like, who I've seen some people say, like, the real villain of the piece is Val, to even, like, kind of ask his parents to do this in the first place, to, like, have to, can you pretend to be straight? And obviously, yeah, funny stuff comes out of that. Like, that moment, that them sequences when they're, like, going back and forth about, like, how to act like a straight man, whether it's how to butter some bread or talking about sports or
walk like John Wayne.
I love that. I love that. And it's like, when Albert says, was there something wrong with that? He's like, no, it's perfect. I just never realized how weird John Wayne walked. I was like,
right.
I loved it. Amazing. Well, yeah, that's The Birdcage. So as we wrap things up, Carson, I always like to ask my guests, did they manage to find any Coppola connections within the film? Were were there people who worked in this film on screen or behind the scenes who worked with the Coppolas elsewhere in their filmography? Did you manage to find any?
I don't.
I got a quick list. If not, I can rattle some off.
Yes, please do.
So we got Robin Williams, who was in Jack, which was directed by Francis Ford Coppola. He was also in Night of the Museum 2, along with Hank Azaria. And yeah, Jonathan Schwartzman was the cinematographer for that. Nathan Lane does the voice of Ham Egg in Astro Boy, which Nicolas Cage is also in. Gene Hackman is in The Conversation, which is directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And Diane Weist is in Edward Scissorhands, which Stephanie Schwartzman also worked on that film. So there are our Coppola connections for this episode.
God, their arms are in everything.
Yes, yeah, yeah. They've worked with everyone. I kind of just for fun the other day, I just picked a random film and saw how many clicks through IMDb I could get back to the Coppola family. And I don't know, I think I might do it as like a Twitch live stream where I just get people to like,
yeah,
give me a film, just like share my screen and like, yeah, kind of like, all right, let's see, can we do it in less than 10? Like,
yeah, that's fun. That's really funny. I like this.
Yeah, I'm gonna be like the Rain Man of the Coppola family, just kind of like, all right, this connects to this connects to that.
Yes.
So before I let you go, Carson, let's rate this film. And the way we do that on this podcast is, what would be the perfect wine pairing or the Birdcage?
Oh, this begs for a nice sharp Chardonnay.
Oh yes.
Oh my God, with 3 ice cubes in it.
Because red wine has tannins in it. White wine, yes, does not.
Exactly.
I think that's perfect. I think, yeah, that or something with a little bit of fizz, because there's a lot of fizz in this film. I think a little, like maybe a Prosecco or kind of a sparkling wine. I think this film has that energy.
Yeah, I like that. I definitely, you know, I gave it a Chardonnay because that's what I imagine like older women on South Beach drinking.
Perfect.
And like that's the feeling that it evokes for me.
Amazing. So how much are we paying for this wine, aka is the film any good? Is it bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf wine?
You know, this is not a wine that you buy at a store. This is strictly a wine that restaurants purchase in bulk from a distributor. And we're paying about, it'll run $18 a glass and somewhere between $65 to $78 a bottle, depending on the night of the week.
Nice, nice. We're going on to that second page of the wine menu. We're not looking at the house. The house can very much we'll pass on that stuff. I love it. Yeah, I think this is definitely like top shelf. I think like there's something. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this film, and yeah, again, I thank you for kind of opening my eyes to it and showing me the light that is the Birdcage.
It was my pleasure.
So can we say, based on this film alone, mm-hmm, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
Based on this film alone?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes. no more comments on that. Perfect. So yeah, let's wrap this up, and I always like to end on 2 questions. The first being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so you get rid of the entire filmography of the rest of the family?
Jesus. Okay, this took a really dark turn.
They're all safe. They're not like put into a shredder. They were never born at all. That sounds even darker, doesn't it?
I think. So based on just like soundtracks alone, It's got to be, I got to keep Sofia Coppola. I have to. Before I even like became like a film junkie or like a critic at all, I always really resonated with everything Sofia Coppola. I love her. I love her filmography. I can't, like, there's not one film that she's made that I thought, not for me.
Yeah, I think if I'd like, when I eventually like make it out to LA, like one of my like things to visit would just be like a tour of locations that Sofia uses, yes, in her films, whether it's the Bling Ring or somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure if you can get to that pool that they dive in somewhere. Like, I'm sure it probably is
possible.
Yeah, have to break into the Chateau Marmont, but it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Amazing. So I always end on this question, which is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Okay. I was thinking about this, and I think what he says, he has a confession.
Ooh.
And I think he becomes self-aware, maybe even sentient, and he says to her, I am a horrific person, and I don't deserve your time, energy, or attention, and I'm going to eject myself off of this earth now.
Yes, yes. Yeah. obviously that this question has obviously taken a turn since things have I think a lot of people have like kind of said, like with Bill Murray, because you don't have to do a lot of digging to kind of read about his past and kind of complaints about him.
See, but it's not even Bill Murray himself, it's just the character. I think people like, that's a bad character.
He's a bad guy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's cheating on his wife. Like, he's, you know, and like, he's using Scarlett Johansson in that movie as like escapism. I don't think he actually cares about her or like what she has to say, or, you know, he's just kind of like using it as someone to talk at instead of talk to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So that's what I think he says. I think it's like, I don't deserve your time or attention. Goodbye.
That's perfect. That's probably, yeah. I totally misread it as like Bill Murray like kind of coming out of character and being like, hey Scarlett, I'm a bad guy, I'm like, in years to come I'll be groping people on sets.
I didn't word that correctly.
No,
what do you think he says?
Well, that will be said on a later episode of the podcast.
whenever you watch Lost in Translation.
Yeah, when that episode finally comes out, it will either be a significant episode like the 100th, or it will be the final ever episode, seeing as this
wow.
question is such like a pertinent question throughout the podcast. And yeah, I guess the final episode will just be a supercut of everyone's answers and then mine.
Oh God. Okay, I'm looking forward to that. That sounds like fun. Oh my God.
So Carson, thank you so much and coming and making some Coppola connections with me. Where can people find you and everything you're doing with Movie Mavens?
Yeah, so you can listen to Movie Mavens wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, maybe even like iHeartRadio, I don't know, wherever you listen. You can catch us on Twitter at Movie Mavens Pod, where we often put up polls that you can vote on for our double features. And you can follow us on Instagram at Movie Mavens. And you can find Annie and I on Twitter, on Instagram. Reach out. We love talking about movies. Hit us up. Annie's gonna be on in a couple of weeks, I guess, to talk about Jurassic Park Dominion.
Yes.
Shout out to that episode.
Amazing. Again, thank you so much for coming and joining me and making these Coppola connections.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was great. Thank you.
And there we have it, guys. Another episode down, another film checked off the amazingly long list. I think recently, I may have said this again recently, yeah, I'm going to be doing this podcast for at least another 3 years. And that's about all of the kind of Nicolas Cage detours that we take revisiting his films or any new films that he comes going out. So, oh boy, if you're... hope you're in it for the long run, guys, because I know I am. I say that. I'm sure there's loads of podcasts who are like, well, I'm doing this for the foreseeable future, so what's 3 years? But we're going go on forever. I'm going to be, yeah... I thought about it recently. It's going to be crazy. I'm going to possibly be like 40 still talking about Nicolas Cage. Because he's still got good innings in him, I reckon. So, and the Coppola family are going to keep on going. So, yeah, I'm going to be here forever. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, if you enjoyed this film, please let me know what you thought of it by... head over to all the socials, that's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd and TikTok, all at Caged In Pod. Or if you'd like to drop me an email, you can do so, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. If you'd like to support this podcast financially, I know times are tough at the moment, but yeah, if you've got any spare cash, would like to become a Patreon, you can. Oh, you can, for as little as £2.50 a month, for like $3, you can join the Movie Brat Bros tier, where currently we are going through every single Brian De Palma film, having a little chin wag, and how his career compares to Francis Ford Coppola's at the year that film was released. So the last episode we put out was The Untouchable, so it would have been 1987. So we can see at the end how that fared up against Gardens of Stone, which I talked about a few weeks ago here on this podcast with Sean Fennessy. So that's a lot of fun, and my kind of love for Brian De Palma has grown again recently in my kind of COVID stupor. I've just been watching Brian De Palma films a lot. I watched Billy Friedkin films as well. I watch, what was it, To Live and Die in LA and Sorcerer for the first time the other day, and was blown away by both of them. I think To Live and Die in LA really taps into something I enjoy, which is the prestige Dutch scumbag, that I learned from Sean Fennessy and Chris Ryan over on Big Picture. I love that term, and it's kind of having the words to something I've enjoyed in cinema for kind of my whole life. It's the prestige scumbag, and Sorcerer is just wow, what a film. I absolutely loved it. It's I'm sure I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but yeah, check that out. I've been listening to the score ever since, kind of. And those moments I kind of pop outside for some fresh air. I just kind of had the Sorcerer score in my ears. Well, yeah, that's enough. I don't know why it's turned into Petrus's COVID diary, but here we are. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of films. I've been having as much fun as I possibly can, whilst kind of trying not to lose my mind. And I don't know, from speaking to people, I think COVID's really hit me quite bad. And as we're speaking now, I'm going to off tomorrow, because I can't get out to get my prescription, obviously, and the prescription won't be ready until tomorrow, and family member will pick it up for me, but I've got a chest infection as well, so the joys. So, as for next week on the podcast, it's a real fun one, and... I'm sure already you're probably fed up with Jurassic World, Jurassic Park chat. I'm sure that every podcast in the world has either talked about it, or from what I'm seeing on the online discourse, everybody is laying boots into Jurassic World Dominion. But let's take a step back, because I was joined by Will Chich and Russell Bailey of the fantastic Not Just For Kids podcast to talk about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and it's kind of really great chat. We kind of talk about Jurassic Park through the lens of being parents. When's the best time? When's the kind of entry point in the Jurassic Park ephemera to get your kids involved? We talk about our problems with that film, things we disliked, things we liked. It's a whole lot of fun. So that's there for you to enjoy next week. And then the week after that, well, you have to listen to next week's outro to find out what that's going to be. If you would like to support this podcast and you don't want to give me any of your money, that is perfectly fine. What you can do instead is to rate, review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. Remember, leave 5 stars, and in your review, please be sure to write what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. So as ever, I've been Petros Patsalivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Droop Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.